Hello, hello. This is Alex Burkett, and you are listening to the Long Game Podcast. In this conversation, I'm chatting with Noah Greenberg. Noah is the CEO of Stacker, the first content distribution platform built for earned reach. Stacker helps brands turn their owned media into earned media by taking their editorial content and getting it republished in full across thousands of news outlets as earned organic coverage to drive backlinks, brand mentions, and new readers. Over 4,000 news outlets rely on Stacker's platform to enhance their coverage, while leading brands, nonprofits, and institutions use it to amplify their insights and research at scale. In this conversation, we talk about the shift from SEO to GEO, how Stacker relates to that shift, and how earned media and public relations more broadly plays into this new model of organic discovery. We talk about the rising trends of brands hiring journalists, creating in-house media operations or media companies, and generally becoming the source material to attract and earn the trust of audiences. In the convo, we weave in sort of metrics and KPIs and how they may change from, you know, SEO to AI visibility, organizational structures and how they may change as well, who currently owns, who does own, and who should own AI search and brand visibility within a company, tactics for increasing your success rate with original research and earned media coverage, and much, much more. Without further ado, here is my conversation with Noah Greenberg. You said that people used your platform for SEO. My assumption that was with Stacker, people would use it more for like PR, people would use it to like get distribution, but you're saying a primary use case was SEOs.
So I would say of the 100 some odd brands that distribute content on our platform, everyone sits somewhere on the spectrum of, on one side, PR. It is, we have content, we need more people, no one's coming to our blog, we need more readers, let's get that distributed. On the other side of that spectrum is SEOs, who are saying, we have this content, we need backlinks, and getting my story republished with canonicals and do follows across 100, 200 news outlets is the most cost-effective way they've found to get backlinks. And so a lot of our customers are buying strictly for SEO, or that at least the budget is coming out of SEO, even if we're working with the content team. So it's funny, like early on, my sales strategy was reaching out to someone on editorial or content, whether it be the managing editor, the editor-in-chief, whoever it was at these brands, and basically saying, we can get your content distributed onto news outlets. Do you want to talk? They'd get on the phone and say, I would love to have my content show up across Yahoo and Miami Herald and San Francisco Chronicle. I don't have a budget for that though, so let me go look internally. And they'd usually set up a call the next week with their head of SEO, who's like, I heard you can get our content republished with links. And so a lot of the times the budget's coming from SEO, even if we're working with content, or the budget will be coming from comms and PR.
That's maybe like a knot we could untangle together, because I feel like we also, as an organic growth agency, we do work with different departments. Sometimes it's content and editorial. Most of the time it's with the director of marketing, who's got like organic as a generality under the bucket.
Yeah.
We're seeing more PR, more brand people come into the conversations. But I'm wondering, so the platform hasn't changed necessarily, like fundamentally over the past few years.
No.
So you're doing effectively the same thing. You're taking a piece of content, a narrative, a data-driven story, and echoing that through the web and media and publications. It's syndicating it, it's getting distribution on it. However, the objective for the people you're selling to, the customers,
is over
changing
time.
Right. Yeah. So that it was backlinks, now it's brand mentions, right?
Yeah, I'd say for 6 years now we've been taking content, you know, what brands would consider their own media stuff they were already producing and publishing on their blog, and saying, that's a really good piece of content. There are a lot of news outlets that would want that piece of content to run on their own site when they have a slow news day. We're going to help you do that. And originally, people were saying, we're going to do that for SEO. We need links. You're able to get us links across lots of high domain rating sites. Then we started to break into the PR and comms team, who said, oh, this is really valuable for just getting more readers for the content and getting our message out there. And then this year, this concept of GEO has kind of you know, swept everything to the side. And I think what's really interesting is we're seeing sometimes GEO is the SEO team's remit. Sometimes it's PR and comms' remit. I think especially the past few months, it's been kind of a wild west of like, who's going to own this? And I think, yeah, it's kind of the middle of that Venn diagram of those two groups.
Who do you think should own GEO? That was a question I was going to ask later, but you already brought it up. So
yeah, I mean, I think that whoever owns GEO needs to have analytical skill set, which is why I think SEO has probably kind of elbowed in and mm-hmm. said this should be our thing, because they are usually, I think the SEO team is used to having to show data-driven ROI. Here's how my rankings have improved. Whereas PR and comms is more used to, here's some coverage we got. And you should believe that that's valuable. And even though PR is the one impacting, I think SEO has kind of done a little bit of a land grab. I definitely think there's an opportunity for those two teams to work together. I also think if you fast forward 5 years, should these orgs shift to work a bit more in cahoots? Possibly, probably. But I think, you know, SEO historically, so much of SEO was on page. It was meta tags. It was optimizing, you know, just how the text showed up, how the page was set up. And so it made sense for this kind of technical SEO group who had that context and knowledge to run it. But now that most of what people are saying will get you cited in LLMs is offsite, or what you might consider like product marketing of making sure you have the right, you know, Q&A on your site, et cetera. It's more content than mm-hmm. anything else. It's up to the content people to actually do the things that will make impact. But having worked with a lot of PR and comms people, there are some that are very analytical and there are some that would rather say, I'm good with content and I don't need to dig into a spreadsheet. But I think that every GEO team is going to need that spreadsheet person to understand what are the terms we want to win on. Now let's go take action.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wonder where this is going to land, because in some sense, you can see SEO's elbowing in of GEO, in the sense that like some of the models or the mental models we're using for GEO and AI visibility resemble the previous paradigm, right? So you've got AI visibility, and I've even heard people say, how do you rank in ChatGPT, yeah. right? Like, have you heard that language?
Yeah.
That's coming from SEO.
So much part of the vernacular.
But
yeah.
You don't rank, right? Like, it's not like a ranking thing. It's a probabilistic thing.
Yeah, it's your ranking number one.
and there's something, I don't think a lot of people have talked about this yet, but the first order is like, all right, so you've got the set of prompts. Hopefully they relate to your category. Hopefully you show up in them.
Yep.
It's sort of like, I want to go from like 0 to 20, 20 to 50, 50 to 100. I want to like be the most visible. But there's this other element that's sort of like how you're spoken about, the story, the narrative. And you spoke to some of that with like the FAQs and the on page content, you know, about your product.
Yeah.
But a lot of that's done off page, a lot of how your brand's spoken about, and that gets pulled into these models. And that's kind of the first touch point. And that's where I feel like the PR paradigm needs to fit into GEO in a way that it hasn't yet. It seems like most of the model is still using like SEO language, if that makes sense.
It does. And yes, I think the biggest difference for me from SEO to GEO has been that a single piece of PR can impact how you're showing up in ChatGPT or Gemini, et cetera. Whereas you never were able to get a link and say, look, we changed rankings because of that link. And so there is an opportunity for the people actually getting that citation to show the impact in a way that they never have before, but they're just not used to thinking about that.
So let me ask you in terms of the value, and you could take perception of value and also like truly like expected value, or like the value of doing something with Stacker, somebody using it for backlinks versus somebody using it for PR and like to distribute their story. And then this new thing of like trying to inform GEO and like kind of how you're showing up in AI engines.
Yeah.
Has what you've built gotten more valuable in the AI paradigm?
Yes.
And is the perception of it more valuable too?
So perception is reality. And the answer is yes. I would say this year, I mean, really this summer, so many deals, you know, clients reaching out, talking to us that usually would have said, this is really interesting. Once we get into our Q4 budgeting, let's talk again, said, we need this now. And I think that is largely because the perceived value of earned media has skyrocketed over the past few months. You know, we're in this very early phase. I think what we took for granted with Google and SEO was like, yes, there was debate over do backlinks still matter as much as they did 10 years ago, but there was a playbook that everyone agreed this is what you need to do. And a lot of that was dictated and kind of published by Google. You had people like Matt Cutts coming out and saying, this is how Google works. That's not happening at all for ChatGPT. Everything that, or, you know, any LLM, everything that people are saying, this is how we think LLMs work and how to show up, is coming from primary research, from bloggers, you know, third parties, companies, you know. So you have like Muckrack put out a big study and Ahrefs has put out a big study, and, you know, you have individuals that are publishing their own primary research. So everyone's kind of triangulating between what third parties are saying, not what the actual LLMs are saying in terms of how the model works. And I think that's a really important distinction, but it also leaves us in this place where you kind of got to get out there and figure out what works, but you also at a certain point need to start to triangulate what are people saying. And it seems like the probably the biggest thing that everyone has consensus on is earned media and third-party citations is impacting results. And we have kind of gotten to ride that wave. We definitely did not start Stacker 8 years ago saying, let's help people show up in ChatGPT. But this year, I think helping people kind of draw that line between this is what all the really technical white papers say happens or what works, and that's pretty much exactly what our product does, has made the product more valuable.
All right. I have a lot of follow-up questions on that, but I did write down, this is the first thing I wrote down, by the way, PR, earned media. When I started my career in 2014, I actually studied advertising and PR in college, right? But when I got out into the working world, PR was not cool. Like, I worked in startups, and in startups, like in that era, it was all like growth hacking was the big thing. Everybody wanted compound channels, virality, product-led growth, like something that you could like model out, right? And PR in that era, I'm not saying this is right or wrong, was looked at as like this old school, like you shoot out a press release, you get a spike of traffic from people who are irrelevant, and then that doesn't compound. It doesn't build growth. However, the last couple of years, PR seems cool again. Is that true to say?
I would, you know, as someone who has not been in PR for very long, I would say the narrative from the people in PR and comms and just marketing in general is that, yeah, PR is having a big comeback. I mean, I've heard a lot of jokes about the press release is cool again.
It's crazy.
Press release was something that, you know, had really fallen off in terms of something, you know, as a main tool in PR and comms toolkits. But now that people are seeing that you can publish a press release, and that text is then kind of informing how models cite you and talk about you, press releases are kind of back in vogue in a lot of ways. So yes, I think PR and comms is definitely having a resurgence.
I remember writing a press release back in college for an internship, and then I don't think I wrote one ever since. But now it's like with our agency, I'm like, should we be doing press releases for our company, you know, for our clients?
So the thing that I will say is that I think that PR becoming cool again is one piece of the fact that brand is becoming important again.
Totally.
So if I, you know, the way I think to like revisionist history, abridged history of marketing is brand was important. You had like Mad Men days of, you know, tell a cool story, help people really feel emotionally your product, et cetera. And then Google and then Facebook kind of took brand away, and it just became about optimization. It became like the people who ruled marketing were the people who could come up with a couple of different ad creatives and then basically be in a spreadsheet optimizing click-through rates and ROAS. And that's kind of the birth of customer acquisition cost and ROAS and CPC, et cetera, et cetera. And brand kind of fell to the wayside because you could launch a company, whether it was D2C, mattresses or software or anything, and how you acquired customers and how well you acquired customers was just kind of math, more or less, to oversimplify it. And that became really oversaturated. One, because everyone got good at it. And two, I think more recently, because the cost of starting a company with AI is nothing. So there's just way more companies flooding the market and way more companies competing in that very efficient marketplace of either Google Ads or Facebook Ads. And so that has made brand way more important, because it turns out the way to get a customer, the way to honestly increase your click-through rate when you're advertising on Google is, has someone heard of me? Mm-hmm. Do they trust me? And the way to do that is press. You know, we have a client in the telehealth space. So they, you know, they sell ED meds and hair loss meds, and you can imagine, you know, what one of those companies might be.
Yeah.
They spend about 10 grand a month on us. I said, why do you invest so much in PR? And I think their answer kind of really illuminated, you know, how this works in all, for a lot of industries, is they said, look, we spend a ton of money on performance advertising, Google, Facebook, Instagram, et cetera. We know that if you see one of our ads and you've never heard of us, there's a very low likelihood you're going to buy ED meds from a company you've never heard of.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you have heard of us, or better yet, if you trust us, if you've been getting your health news from our brand, much higher likelihood that you're going to convert. And so again, I think as brand has become more important, PR has kind of not been swept up in that, but is kind of benefiting from that pendulum shift.
That's really interesting. This is a little bit of a heady idea. I wrote a newsletter that just came out today.
Okay.
And it was more of a meditation, or like a reflection, as opposed to a series of answers or tactics. But I had this thought that's been recurring over the past few weeks through multiple conversations, that the influence factor is like untracked and more important, like I just mentioned, kind of like how you're spoken about in these systems, and that influence is upstream of measurable behavior. So in the ad example, it's like previous familiarity, right?
Yeah.
If you know somebody and you've seen them before, click-through rate is higher, and that's the measurable behavior. But the unmeasurable part is like how familiar they are. Like it's a harder thing to measure. And similarly, it's like in AI search, a lot of people are like, oh, it's only 1% of our website traffic, but it converts at 10% versus like all other channels, you know, convert at 1%. And you're like, well, that's because the influence that's happening is happening
before
in the platform, and that's happening. And even preceding that, it's like the influence is actually happening on media publications and Reddit and the sources that are getting pulled in through ChatGPT or something like that. So it's like, to care about that means that like that first touch point that somebody hears about you, you know, that's kind of the weighing factor as to like how likely they are to push forward and actually try your product, buy your product, consider you in the conversation at all, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Which is a scary time, because it's like all that untrackable, unmeasurable stuff. It's like, what do you do with that? Like, I can't model that out.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that at a certain point you have to believe.
Gotta have faith.
And, you know, the best thing that I've been able to do is look at examples where you're saying, I know that that's how this works. Again, to me, finding these anecdotes like the, you know, ED company that says no one's going to buy our product if they've never heard of us. We need people to trust us and know us. The way to do that is media, is content, is, you know, having people read about us, read from us. And I do think, we were talking about this earlier, that's what's really driven a lot of these brands to say, let's actually be the news source, be one of the media companies that our customers or potential customers are consuming.
That's a very interesting, it's like two sides of the coin. There's like, let's get into that in a second. I wanted to ask you about like the quantification thing, because you'd mentioned like a backlink is hard to track in terms of its impact. It's a sort of facilitation function in that like more backlinks tends to equal a stronger website, which makes it easier to rank content that eventually turns into traffic and conversions.
Yeah.
But you couldn't track the value of a given backlink. But you mentioned that you can sometimes track the value of a given brand mention or a story.
Yeah.
In the sense that it raises your visibility against a prompt in AI, or even you show up as a citation source that influences the output in like AI overviews. Have you seen examples of that in your customer base where it's like, all right, we got like a story placed and now all of a sudden we've got stronger visibility and that's actually like palpable and measurable in that sense?
Definitely. I think we're seeing so many examples where you publish a story and then the next day you search queries around that topic and that article is being cited as, you know, kind of as the brand mentioned, as the citation. And that obviously wasn't happening the day before. Whereas again, I think it was very rare to publish a story and then have that show up number one on Google for a relevant query, right? So examples of that are, you know, maybe We work with Redfin. Redfin will put out a story looking at how mortgage rates changed last month in, you know, each state kind of thing. And they have a bunch of data from their platform about how mortgages are changing and, you know, kind of corresponding and around that data, right? We'll see that story publish. And then the next day, if you come in and say to ChatGPT, I live in California, is it a good time to get a mortgage? It'll cite that story from yesterday and say, well, mortgage rates changed this much, this, you know, and it's kind of using that data. But it will say, according to Redfin data, mortgages changed this much. And again, Redfin is doing that, but the reality is anybody could do that. And I think it gives any brand an opportunity to just compete much more quickly. We are still figuring out, and I think, you know, kind of the jury is still out on what is the equivalent in GEO of what was domain rating or domain authority in SEO. I think, you know, what was very frustrating for a lot of startups in SEO was if you didn't have domain rating, you could not compete. You know, if you were a new company and you were trying to compete and your domain rating was 18, but everyone else was an 80, like you just weren't going to get number one for a lot of the really high value queries. Whereas we are seeing that a site that has no quote unquote authority is able to get content either that they're publishing or a piece of earned media about them. So I think what's really exciting about earned media is that Redfin or anyone else can take that research they did, they can get it published on Yahoo Finance. And all of a sudden, when someone goes in and says, is it a good or a bad time to get a mortgage? It will read the Yahoo Finance story and say, according to Redfin data. And so it's kind of driving value at that top of funnel in a way that just didn't exist in SEO.
It's so fascinating, first off, how fast this stuff works compared to Google search and yes. indexation and ranking. Yeah. Like that next day turnaround is something I've seen a lot, heard a lot about.
I mean, if you look into the back ends of these platforms, like these models are scraping people's sites multiple times a day.
Oh, yeah.
So it can literally
be... You can see it in your log files,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, exactly.
It's insane. This is a really tough question to unpack, and I don't think there's any like causal factors here, but Redfin is obviously like a well-known brand with probably a strong domain, yet they still distribute this to like Yahoo, and you'd mentioned like a couple other publications. Is there an advantage to, like, what if they had just published it on their own site? Like, is there an additional advantage to distributing it more broadly? And
yes. So, I mean, we are seeing just about double the citations from distributing your content out to news outlets. So if you push a story out and maybe that article is getting cited across 30 prompts that you want to win for, we're seeing an additional 30 prompts citing other sources. The reality is, if you think about it, like with these models, you're just taking a shot, right? You have no idea what content they're going to reference. And so there's one world where Redfin just has it on their site. There's another world where that same content and data is being published across 100 other sites. ChatGPT goes and scrapes all 101 of those sites. And there's just more opportunities, more surface area for that brand to have their data, have their whatever content that they're putting out there referenced.
Yeah, I guess the mental model there is like, it may be an opaque system in terms of how it chooses those sources, but it seems like right now there's no penalty to being broadly distributed. So in the sense of domain rating and like spammy domains, like yep. there may have actually been a net negative to appearing or having a backlink or brand mention on a website in Google search. Maybe not net negative, but like if you spam and you know you're linked to a bunch of like PBN style sites, like
okay.
that may signal something to Google that you're like doing something black hat, right? Whereas ChatGPT doesn't seem to have
black
like that risk, you know? So it's really more probabilistic. So all you're doing is kind of increasing the probability. I wouldn't say do black hat stuff anyway. Like that's not...
It was interesting. So I was at the Profound conference 2 weeks ago, and probably the most interesting concept that was said on stage was that Google has spam rules and you should not, you know, we've seen what happens when you break those rules. ChatGPT, Claude, Gemini, like none of them have come out and said, this is what you should not do.
Mm-hmm.
And so until they come out and say what you shouldn't do, anything is fair game. Just make sure you're not doing it in a way where you can't unravel it should the rules change. But I thought it was just an interesting point of until those rules, there are no rules.
Yeah, that makes sense. And then the mental model there is merely probability. It's like if you have more input data and sources, the probability that you appear in the output is likely higher. No matter which source, it's like weighing more heavily. Because I'm sure, I don't know how these systems work, but like I'm sure ChatGPT is like favoring or weighing certain publications or sources or URLs higher. That's a theory. You know, you just see it with like Reddit and Wikipedia, even though those are like, you know, long-standing websites with like tons of tentacles into every industry, which is like also why they're appearing a lot. But also I'm sure there's some weighing of variables where it's like, okay, it's unlikely Wikipedia is going to be total bullshit. So like we can put a little heavier weight on that one.
But
the probability there is like just distribute it as broadly as you can, because you've got the data, you've got the piece, you've got the research, you might as well kind of increase your surface area and your odds of appearing in the outputs.
Yeah, because I think that the big difference between showing up in LLMs and showing up on Google is you're not aiming for traffic, right? So with Google, it's like, I want this user back to my site. And if the information is being read on a different site, someone will click through to get that information, but not end up on my site. Whereas in these models, users are usually not clicking off of ChatGPT. They're getting there and getting the information, but ChatGPT is referencing who that information came from. So I think it just represents kind of a new paradigm where brands are just looking for, I want to make sure I'm part of the conversation, even if it's a third party that's talking about me.
Do you think that PR teams, earned media teams are going to have more quantifiable KPIs with visibility scores and citation rates and all that?
I mean, I think that gets into how we, at the top of this, we were talking about, I think there might be org changes and what we think of as PR or SEO or marketing.
It's, you know, so I do think,
you know,
now
marketing will have these initiatives, and I think it's, you know, will it be the same PR person today that manages that in a year? Maybe not, but I do think people in PR will start to need to think about these. I mean, already PR teams have metrics on how much press they're getting. But do I think it could go a level deeper? I think it should.
I'm fascinated to see that. It's almost like SEO is becoming less quantifiable and like growth marketing oriented. It's becoming a little bit more brandy. And then PR and brand are becoming a little bit more quantifiable and like growth oriented.
Yeah.
It's all coming together in the middle a little bit. All right. So brand is media company. I wanted to talk about that. But before we do, you'd mentioned a couple of things on Stacker. Which I'll do an intro and like talk about Stacker and all that stuff. You don't need to do the elevator pitch, but I wanted to know with this change and GEO coming to fruition, it seems like a lot's changed in your world. You're getting a influx of interest from maybe even different parties, but what was your inception for the idea of Stacker? And like, how has that changed? Like what is the origin story of what you built?
The origin story of what we built, candidly, is, I mean, on day one, it was that my co-founders and I were working at another startup. The startup got bought by Amazon. We got fired, our team got deprecated, and we started a company to not have to find jobs elsewhere. And that company at the time more or less realized that there were large platforms like MSN, Yahoo, AOL that paid a rev share for content. We spooled up a newsroom and started syndicating to those platforms for rev share, and basically built both a newsroom, but also built a distribution channel. And over time, we started giving that content to other news outlets. So fast forward a couple of years, and when our newsroom would publish a story, that story would get placed on 50 or 60 different news outlets. Maybe it would show up on San Francisco Chronicle or mysanantonio.com or Yahoo or MSN, et cetera. And it was a few years later in 2020 that kind of more of a snippet of what Stacker has become evolved, where we realized we had the power to publish a piece of content and get that republished across dozens of different news outlets, and that was really valuable to an increasing number of brands. And so we started working with brands first to actually help use our newsroom to produce content on their behalf as an agency and let them underwrite journalism that our team was producing, right? So let's say we were working with Experian. Our newsroom wanted to produce a piece about how changes to student debt laws were impacting different states differently. Experian would underwrite that. They would get the original version on their site, and then we would syndicate that out to dozens of news outlets. So Experian, for backlinking purposes, would get a piece published across lots of sites. Pretty quickly, though, a lot of our clients started to come to us and say, we're hiring our own journalists. We're building our own newsroom in-house. Why are we paying you to make this content? And as we looked at that content, it was really good because we have seen that a lot of brands are hiring journalists, statisticians, economists. And so over the past couple of years, basically in 2023, we started to flip the model where we started sourcing content from great newsrooms at brands, vetting that content to make sure that it still met the same editorial standards that our newsroom was abiding by, and then providing that as a free newswire to thousands of news outlets. And that is what the business is today, is we're working with about 150 brands to source content that their content teams or newsrooms are producing and help that get placed across hundreds of news outlets.
I promise you I'm going to ask about the brands hiring journalists.
No rush.
But did you have a background at all in, and I might have missed this, but did you have any background in journalism or media or PR before you started Stacker?
No, I mean, I, in a past life, spent about 6 years doing business development, pitching a product into newsrooms. So I was not a journalist.
But you understood the business
model.
But
I understood how newsrooms worked, and I understood the pain point and or the appetite of newsrooms for more third-party content that they could run on their sites. Newsrooms have relied on things like AP, Associated Press Wire, Reuters Wire content. You know, the concept of a newsroom saying, we need to fill this gap in our coverage. Let's rely on a third party to put a story on our site is not new. They've been doing that for 100 years. But as the amount of content coming out of brands that was really good editorial increased, I think the number of PR pitches to editors just skyrocketed, right? If you're a journalist, you're getting 100 pitches a day of, take a look at my story. And so really what we did is we created this curated wire of really premium content that we were able to push into those newsrooms. But yeah, my background was in understanding, and that was one of kind of the key unlocks early on, was realizing that the editor at the Miami Herald, when they're having a slow day on their business section, that they would love a piece from SoFi about breaking down a recent survey about how millennials feel about debt.
I guess, yeah, my curiosity there, and it sounds like there was a little bit of understanding of the business model, but you've got to become sort of expert in all these different areas. And then now with GEO, I read an article you wrote, I think on Substack or I don't know, your newsletter or something. It was online about like your learnings at, on GEO and how you got up to speed in your current understanding. So like that's a net new thing, right?
Yeah.
None of us had experience with that. So my curiosity was around your personal, I guess, operating system for diving into kind of the deep end of a pool and figuring out like an industry or a topic, given especially GEO, it's like, all right, this is a fast turnaround. So how do you learn stuff?
It's conversations and reading, which seems to oversimplify it. But the reality is, I think, honestly, one of the things that I am both proudest of in my 8 years at Stacker, but also kind of surprised about, is my ability to be an expert on something 2 years later. And I think anyone can do that. It's not that I have some special skill in that, but I think people underestimate how much you can learn about a topic over a year or two. And I think specifically with GEO, it's even easier to become a quote unquote expert quickly because no one's an expert and the term GEO didn't exist 12 months ago. So my process for learning about things is just having as many conversations as possible. You know, it's figuring out, okay, who's already a quote unquote expert. With GEO, that was people that had been writing about it for 4 months at the time. You know, following their Substacks, following them on LinkedIn, et cetera. It is having conversations like this, talking with other people that are kind of in the arena, testing stuff out. And then it's doing my own research and talking with other people that are doing their own research. So like first 6 months of trying to figure out quote unquote GEO was just a lot of time playing with ChatGPT and saying like, I wonder if this works. You know, I remember there were two cross-country 5-hour flights where I just played with ChatGPT the whole time and said, there's this article that got published on this site. Like, how do I make that show up in ChatGPT? Oh, I can't. And just like kind of primary research. But it really is just getting out there and talking with people and doing a bit of your own primary research of whatever the topic is.
Yeah. It's funny you say that like it's an obvious thing in a way, but I think a lot of people with GEO don't have that sense of filtering or like going to the source. That's the understanding that I have is like you go to the source, like you talk to the people who seem to know what they're doing. Mm. And that's like with, I guess, like media and newsrooms, like there's a little bit more of a history. You could honestly probably find books about this stuff, whereas GEO, you can't necessarily find books about it. So there is a filtering that needs to take place in terms of like who you deem is worth like trustworthy sources. And then also you're tinkering on your own, which I also think is important.
That's fair. But I would push back and say, yes, you could go read a book on how newsrooms work. But the reality is, you know, digital is changing newsrooms so quickly that a book written 2 years ago is not probably going to tell you what you need to know about the nuance and intricacies of when you get on the phone with a newsroom, who you want to talk to, et cetera. And the only way to do that is just by going and having a ton of conversations. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when I think about launching a new product or entering a new space, a lot of what I'm doing is going and having 50 conversations with potential customers, with people that I don't know if they would actually be a customer or not, because I don't quite know what our product is and who our customer is. But it's getting on the phone with people and asking questions, understanding what their frustrations are, what they're excited about, what they're nervous about, what they feel like they wish they knew more about, et cetera, and starting to put those pieces together, mm-hmm. Which I do think can only really happen from having 50 conversations and kind of triangulating what the map looks like.
Yeah, pattern recognition. You can also see sort of where the puck is going or where the open questions are. On that note, media. So brand, media, all that stuff. We've touched on this. We've glossed over it. I've delayed asking you the question. This is one of your notes on the intake form, but you said we're in a, quote, underground but massive trend of brands hiring journalists. Is this a new thing? If so, why now? What's happening?
It's not a new thing. This concept of every company is a media company has been around for a while. I think that the pace and level of investment has skyrocketed the past couple of years. And the pace and level of investment in what? In brands investing in content where the purpose of that content is not to convert someone into a customer that day, but it is to win the trust and authority of potential customers so that they may buy in the future. So what are examples of this? You know, in 2021, you had HubSpot buy The Hustle. The Hustle was this big business newsletter. They had a podcast. They had millions of readers or listeners. HubSpot bought them. They turned off all the ads. And they basically made a bet that if people get their news and information about how to build a business from HubSpot, then when it is time to buy a CRM, they're going to be a little bit more likely to buy HubSpot. Hmm. And that actually happened with Stacker. I'd been listening to The Hustle or My First Million and reading The Hustle for about 4 years before they got bought. Then for 4 years, I was getting, you know, whispered little sweet nothings of HubSpot brought you this podcast. And HubSpot wasn't impacting the content. It wasn't, here's how I built my company on HubSpot. It was just HubSpot's giving you this free content. And then a few years later, our sales team came and they said, we want to change our CRM to HubSpot. It's twice as expensive as the next option, but we really want it. And I said, oh, I kind of like HubSpot, you know, probably like somewhat subconsciously and somewhat consciously. And I think that works in a lot of different industries. So you have Robinhood has built out a really big media arm. They call it Sherwood Media, but it basically Robinhood now has the equivalent of what you would call like Bloomberg News or CNBC, but for Gen Z and millennials. Hmm. They went and they hired some really incredible journalists. They bought a couple newsletters. And again, the concept is if someone reads their financial information from Robinhood, then when it is time to open up a brokerage account, they're probably more likely to use Robinhood. And so I think that strategy has really taken hold the past couple of years. And the number of companies we're seeing hiring 1, 2, 5 economists or journalists to help just tell the news in their industry has skyrocketed.
What What is the goal behind this? I mean, you'd mentioned, I guess, a form of influence that's a little bit surreptitious in that it's not direct CTAs and saying, like, here's how I did this with HubSpot. But is it, I mean, if you're creating content that's sort of independent of your product, is the goal to attract an audience, to sort of go straight to the source? Like, what is the objective of a marketing or a business leader who's making this decision, which I would imagine is a quite extensive investment and probably a long-term play that's going to take a little bit of time to kind of prove out in traditional quant metrics, right? So, like, what are they trying to do?
They are trying to build trust and brand awareness and honestly, likability. So, and it happens at all different scales, right? So if you are HubSpot, you can spend 20 something million. And if that increases your conversion rate by a couple percentage points, that's, you know, that's worth much more than $20 million, right? At the other end of the spectrum is me as CEO of Stacker, who I'm posting on LinkedIn, not about Stacker. I'm posting about, here's what I'm seeing happening in marketing. People follow me. Hopefully they like me. They trust me over time. And then when they get an email that says, hey, would you like to get on the phone and hear about Stacker? They say, oh, Stacker, I know the CEO. I like what he has to say. And they're much more likely to get on the phone. And so that's a very cheap way of doing this, is posting on LinkedIn. But it's the same philosophy of, if people read content from me that they like, they will be more likely to buy my product.
Mm-hmm. Do you see this as categorically different than somebody who's just a very talented writer or speaker who's in-house? Like, let's say Ryan Law at Ahrefs, right?
Yeah.
He's not always writing about Ahrefs. He's writing some deep thought leadership essays, but yeah, it's not necessarily media company in the same sense that Stripe or Robinhood. Well, I don't know. Maybe it is. If you see that in the same category, let me know. Or even in the old days, like Pep Laya, you know, in CXL writing about conversion rate optimization, it was more educational and technical, but it wasn't necessarily like, work with us, work with us, work with us.
I think it's the exact same thing. So I think it's, okay, you know, Ryan at Ahrefs, if you follow Ryan, you're saying this guy really knows his stuff. And then occasionally he's going to post about an Ahrefs study or a new feature, and you're going to say, I trust this guy, right? Think like an even probably starker example of not promotional of the brand they work at is if you're familiar with Peter Walker at Carta. Mm-hmm. Peter Walker works at Carta. He basically, you know, for people that aren't familiar, Carta is a platform that takes all of your stock, you know, kind of handles your stock grants and your equity and your cap table. They have lots of data about everything having to do with that. Peter's job is more or less to find interesting stories in that data. You know, here's how much companies are raising now versus last year. Here's how much equity people with this title tend to get, et cetera, because they have all of this incredible anonymized data, right? None of this is, here's a feature that you can only track if you buy Carta. It's, here's what's going on in the startup ecosystem. But he has, I think, like 200,000 followers. And all of those founders, or all of those followers, are founders or people in the startup ecosystem. And that's just free advertising for Carta. So, yeah.
Do you think that, this isn't a gotcha question, by the way. With brands creating their own journalism, so to speak, the trust factor, you'd mentioned the goal is to build trust. Like, I'm not saying that independent media and whatever journalism has always been like capital T trustworthy, right? There's phases throughout history, yellow journalism and clickbait and all that stuff. But generally, I think the incentive structure was more aligned with like being, so to speak, objective with a lot of publications. Whereas like a brand, if they're funding the initiative, they sort of have a natural incentive to extract value from that economically.
Sure.
So like, is there an inherent conflict with that? Or like, I guess like how can brands kind of split that and actually build authentic trust versus like it always coming back to like, okay, if Omniscience writing about this, like they clearly want to like sell me on something eventually, right? Or if Noah's talking about this on LinkedIn, like, you know, I'm sure he's beating the drum of what Stacker's doing. Like, how do you kind of split that?
Yeah. So I guess three-part answer. One is, then probably most importantly, there is inherent conflict and the editorial efforts coming out of brands cannot replace independent journalism, right? So I think it's exciting that there's a lot of really amazing research and coverage coming out of these brands. They're hiring a lot of journalists and putting out great stuff that otherwise would not be published. But there cannot be a world where we say, oh, we don't need independent news because it's all getting produced by these parties, right? So that's the first, I think, thing just like worth acknowledging. The second is, I think as a reader, you should always consider what is the inherent bias of the publication I'm reading, right? So let's say you are on a car marketplace, right? Not to name anyone because I don't want people to think they would are doing this, but you can imagine like a website where you might go and decide to buy a car. If they put out a study that it's a great time in the economy to buy a car, you should take that with a grain of salt. Mm-hmm. Because you could also imagine maybe being in that newsroom and doing the study and realizing it's a shitty time to buy a car. And they may squash that story, which again is like, that's their right because they're not an independent news outlet and they're there to put out content that pushes their business forward. So I think as a reader, you always need to be thinking about that, right? But like readers are used to that. Plenty of times when people watch a certain news channel and they hear something, they say, well, they're just saying that because they feel this way, because they lean right or because they lean left, et cetera, right? So I think to ask and expect readers to say, remember that there might be inherent bias and consider that when reading, you know, what is or maybe what is there or what is being omitted is not asking readers of too much. And again, to your point is I don't think the concept of that there might be bias in what you're reading is like, is just for this type of content. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, if you are a brand running this strategy, at the end of the day, you need to remember that you're doing this to build trust and authority with potential future customers. And so you need to think about, you know, if you publish one story that is too obviously just inherently content marketing, people are going to look at you as doing content marketing. And I think you just need to consider that.
I think also, and maybe this is just like a blind spot of mine, I think this is my personal model, yeah. And I think it's yours too, that there's a value in being transparent about your bias or couching what you say in intellectual honesty. And also like you have to imagine that like I'm not going to go out and say like SEO is dead because otherwise, if I believe that, like I would do a different agency, you know what I mean? Or like, you're not going to do like a completely contrary and like inverse take of what you're building and selling. Otherwise you would do something else. But in your essay on, the SEO to GEO shift, I think you had a point where you're like, look, I'm coming at this.
Consider who's saying it. I mean, exactly. I remember very specifically that the first kind of report, the first quote I heard that PR helps ChatGPT was from the SVP of PR at Edelman Agency.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing that and my first thought being, amazing, PR helps, this is great. And then saying, literally, that's this guy's job.
Yeah, you're like wait.
So I do think as you are reading research about GEO or research about anything, you need to kind of remind yourself, what dog does this person have in this fight? And you know, as I talk about things, I definitely remind people, like, I do have a dog in this fight. Like, I am biased when it comes to this. And you need to kind of come to your own decision, but I am going to show you what I'm seeing.
I'm not trying to, like, white knight this or whatever. Like, I think there's, like, who you're speaking to matters a lot. And I always think with our agency and with the messaging we put out, there are ways that we could be more sensational about what's happening to potentially, you know, attract a little bit more demand in the short term. I see it all the time. And it kind of, in my opinion, poisons the dialogue a little bit. And then I have to kind of untangle a lot of that on sales calls. But ultimately, I have to believe that who I want to speak to and who I want to work with is, like, a little bit more discerning. So I have to orient myself towards that. And I think that builds long-term value. I'm also just like allergic to the, you know, the super sensationalist stuff. But yeah,
the last click on Google is tomorrow. And
oh my God. Yeah. It's like the urgency, the FOMO, it's like a ChatGPT copy too. It's not just transformational. It is revolutionary, right? So I don't know. It's also like who you want to be and what brand you want to build. And I would imagine a lot of these companies, well, especially if you're hiring journalists and trying to build a little bit of a trustworthy, prestige is the word that comes to mind. it's in your long-term interest to couch what you do in a sense of like responsibility and not be so...
For sure. And I think that's, you know, one of the biggest changes here is that 10 years ago, the content team at brands came from a marketing background and that today they come from a journalism background.
Mm-hmm. What makes good brand journalism? And I ask that from the trend that you're espousing. So generally, you've given a couple examples of HubSpot, and I want to unpack it actually on a more tactical level, like what makes a good piece of brand journalism and like what ingredients make that up.
Yeah.
But also from your perspective on the distribution level, like what gets picked up on the newswire? Like what is a good piece of brand journalism? It might be a very general question.
Essentially two different questions. But I mean, what gets picked up is interesting content that informs, entertains, or engages a reader. And I think we see that, you know, that's very broad. But the reality is, like, if you're trying to get an article placed on Chicago Tribune or Yahoo, that they cover a really broad range of topics. I think that we see that probably the two buckets that do really well are either anything with unique data. So every company has unique data, right? Ramp has data on how businesses are spending. Square, the POS system, has data on how people are tipping and what time people go out for lunch and et cetera. It's, you know, how many restaurants are opening and closing. And Experian has data on people's credit scores. And so using whatever data you have to tell stories that only you could tell, I think, is kind of a cheat code for earning a lot of media. The other is leveraging your in-house experts to tell what we call news you can use or service journalism, right? So this is, if you are an insurance brokerage, it's putting out content on how to prep your home for hurricane season. You know, the things you should consider before holiday shopping, whatnot. Those are stories that I think, you know, what we'll call softer news or softer content, are also areas that we see a lot of news outlets wanting more coverage in. So that they can focus on the hard news in their communities.
Mm-hmm. Those are like the stories that I see when I swipe left on my iPhone in the morning and it's like some big political thing. And then three down, it's like some autumn trend. Yeah. Or like, you know, like what candles are popular.
I mean,
this
the reality is different people are looking for different things. Like there's a reality, you know, Baskin Robbins has 31 flavors for a reason. And you're going to click on one and someone else is going to click on another.
The question I'm always wrestling with, because I don't have this mindset, but we're trying to build this mindset a little bit more, even for our own marketing, is how can you validate or at least in some sense have some prediction that something's going to be interesting to the media and it has some chance of getting picked up? Like maybe what I find interesting is not as interesting to search engine journal or whatever in my industry, or I don't know, if you're a consumer brand, it's maybe not as interesting to the broader ecosystem. Like, do you have some idea or some model as to how you come up with those ideas for the content in the first place? Or is that kind of...
So, I mean, at Stacker, we have a lot of data about what types of content are and are not getting picked up. And we kind of have tools that we're kind of pulling in that data and providing insights to clients to help them produce content that is more likely to get picked up. The reality is, and you know, anyone who has spent a decade in PR would be much smarter at this than I, but it's looking at what does a reporter cover, right? Like what topics are in vogue now? How can you tie your story to something else that is already happening? And that could be an event or holiday like the Super Bowl. You know, you're much more likely to get the most expensive commercials of all time published in and around the Super Bowl than you are in July, because people's minds are just thinking about, God, it's so expensive to, you know, do a commercial during the Super Bowl, right? So they're thinking about what can I tie my story to that makes it even more relevant today than maybe yesterday or tomorrow.
This may be a silly question too. There's like general trends and like anchors around public interest points. Is there any value in doing essentially account-based marketing for specific journalists and publications? Like if I really, really wanted to get picked up in whatever search engine journal or whatever the publication is, like how individualized do you kind of craft the narratives and the content that you're creating? And it, maybe it matters space by space too. Like maybe there's sources of influence that are just much more salient in your industry that you really want to like capitalize on versus broad distribution. Does that question make any sense?
It does. I will kind of call out that we're talking about two different things of what Stacker is able to do. And my advice for you, if you're trying to get search engine journal to write about you or cover some research you did. So what Stacker does is you put out a story from a survey you did about, you know, how customers feel about this transition to GEO from SEO, right? And you write that story. We take that fully written story. We go to the editor of thousands of news outlets and say, would you like a free story that you can just republish on your site based on this survey, right? And maybe 80 of them say, actually, that seems really interesting. We're going to publish it, right? It's going to be by Alex. What you're talking about is, I have this idea for a survey, or we did the survey. How do I get Search Engine Journal to write about it, right? Or whatever you want to say. And in those instances, yeah, I think, you know, ABM, you have to do that, right? It's, you have this story, you know, the process is, okay, who are the 15 journalists that I could see talking about this? And again, it's not just, hey, I want it on Search Engine Journal. It's who's the person at Search Engine Journal that talks about this type of stuff? Because the reality is at Search Engine Journal, there's probably one person who tends to write about algorithm changes and technical SEO. And there's another person who talks about, you know, covering Google said this and Sam Altman said this, et cetera, et cetera. And there's another person who most of the content they write is, I just talked with the CMO of this brand and here's how they're thinking about the future of SEO. And so it's going and saying, who's actually the most likely to write my story? And doing what you know, account-based marketing to that person.
It almost feels like, to make things concrete, because this is a mental model that we're trying to build, it almost seems useful to think about an individual or a dream publication and then use that as the first data point to inform the topic or research. And then also do the broad distribution, because maybe other people will pick it up. But then at least it gives me a little bit of a concrete idea as to like, okay, what topics should we be thinking about? What angles and open questions are there? It gives me a little more sense as to like, I don't know. Otherwise, I'm just like, oh, I could write about anything. Like, what's on the spectrum? It's like anything in SEO. So it gives me a little bit more, I guess, like structure in terms of like ideation, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. I think, look, there's a top down of here's the publication, here's the person. Now let's brainstorm what stories would be really interesting to them. Mm-hmm. And then there's the bottoms up of I have this story. Who is the most likely person? And I think, you know, some you're going to be in different instances with different kind of press opportunities, right? Sometimes you're going to realize like, oh, I have this opinion. I'm seeing this trend happening. Who wants to hear about it?
How do you do this? And maybe not in the sense of like using Stacker and like going out to the media, but you do your own LinkedIn content. Mm-hmm. You write essays. You're putting out messaging from yourself and from Stacker. And now it's a lot of content around like GEO and also the media, you know, brands hiring journalists kind of trends. But like how can you're also, you'd mentioned getting picked up and doing more podcasts and like there's sort of a serendipitous effect going on. So how do you think about your own kind of messaging and topic and content creation ecosystem or strategy that you're creating?
It is one part what I'm interested in and one part candidly what I think my customers would be interested in. So I have built out kind of a philosophy of audience building of, you know, if you are a founder, if you're an operator, or honestly, if you're a SDR, what does a content strategy look like that is going to drive business for you? Because that is why I started posting on LinkedIn and writing essays was to drive business for Stacker. And I think that the mistake most people make, if that is their goal, is not thinking about who they're actually posting for. And I think that there's two different strategies, one of which is I just want to talk about what I'm interested in and I'm going to do that. And the people that follow me will be the people that are interested in what I'm interested in, right? And I think if you're just going out and launching a podcast because you want to, or you're just starting a newsletter because you want to, I think that's a very good strategy because you will be more interested in it. The content will be more interesting.
That's what I do.
There you go. So, you know, I think like Sean Puri of My First Million, he is, I really like, he talks about like, I'm making this for me, mm-hmm. and the people who listen to this should be the people who care about what I care about.
It's like a magnet. Yeah.
Yes. That is one strategy. That does not work if you are a founder trying to drive customers for your business, or at least it's not guaranteed to work.
Right.
What is guaranteed to work is saying, who are the people I'm trying to get in front of? Who are my potential customers? And what do they care about? Right? So what I did and what I walk other founders through when they're coming up with a content strategy is saying, first, let's pick a single person. Let's pick an actual person and get their LinkedIn profile up on the screen, that if this person cold inbounded to you and said, I've been following you on LinkedIn, I love what you have to say, I love your product, can we get on the phone? You would say, I fucking figured it out, right? So let's pick that person, put them up on the screen, and let's brainstorm, what the hell does this person care about? What are they excited about? What are they scared or nervous about? What do they feel like they need to know more about and learn about, right? And just kind of get all these, like, what does this person care about? And you need to create content about that, right? So, you know, real life example is I'm trying to get in front of SEOs and PRs, kind of April, May of this year. All of those people were wondering, what the hell is GEO? How does it impact my job? How does it work? And so I started putting out content on that. And a lot of that was just reading really technical white papers and then regurgitating it for, if you're in PR, here's how you should consider what's going on with GEO right now, right? But it turns out that for my audience, or my would-be audience that is in PR, that was really valuable content, right? And so then that person follows me because I have interesting things to say that are nothing about Stacker. But then 3 months later, because 1 in 10 posts is about Stacker, they're learning what Stacker is. And I mean, it's funny, just yesterday, someone had a dream client that I didn't even know who they are. They literally DM'd me and they were like, okay, you finally got me. I've been following you for 6 months. I want to know more about Stacker. And I think that is only because 90% of the content I produce has nothing to do with Stacker. It is about what they care about. The way I think about it is, you are building a media company where you are the media company. And once you build the media company, then you have a right to do free advertising mm-hmm. about your company. But you can't, no media company, if when they've launched their first magazine or show, if it was all advertising, people wouldn't watch that. You have to earn the audience and then you can advertise to them for free.
It seems like to me, at least from the outside, that you've hit that sweet spot of kind of calibrating what you're interested in and the customers are interested in.
Definitely.
Which is what I try to do too. It's like, I even like structure it like with what channel I'm using. So like a podcast is like incredibly high effort. So if I'm not interested in the conversation, I'm not going to do it. Like, I'm just going to stop doing these.
Yeah.
So ultimately I'm coming at it like with genuine curiosity.
I'm honored that we've made it this
every
far.
Every question I ask, I'm like, I actually care about, because if I didn't, I would just like, it would come across and I would stop doing them. And then this would just fizzle out. And then there's others where LinkedIn, like I do calibrate with voice of customer a little bit more, although I still only talk about the things that I'm interested in. So GEO is like this very broad area. And some people go into highly technical details on vector embeddings and, like, you know, relevance engineering. And I'm not interested in that, but it's not my core focus. So I don't talk about it. But I'm still within that sphere of like GEO, yeah. And I know what kind of my clients are interested in. And it seems like you've struck that balance too, and that it comes across as genuine and like you want to be here, you know?
I appreciate that. I mean, again, I think it comes down to that knowing who the person you're trying to get in front of is, right? Because if you are trying to get in front of really technical SEOs, you need to be publishing, like, my content is not attracting technical SEOs.
Same.
They're reading, like, they're seeing it and they're like, I know this. Why? You're like, or just like, this is oversimplifying it and stupid, right? So I think it's really important to call out, like, there's a world for that. Maybe it's not your and my world, and maybe it's kind of not what we're not interested in. Maybe we're getting there for different reasons. But I think it goes back to, you need to understand who you're posting for or who you're trying to get in front of, and then make it for them. And for you, maybe that is that what you're really interested in. You're very fortunate in that there's crossover between what you're interested in and what your customers care about. That means you're running a business that you should be running, as opposed to, did you got to get the hell out of this industry?
Yeah, phoning it in.
But I think it comes down to knowing who you're trying to get in front of.
Hell yeah. I think we're out of time. any last words?
No, this has been fun. I feel like we're on Between Two Ferns now that I look at the...
Right, this is great.
Well, thank you so much, man. That was really fun.
Yeah.
That was great.
All right.